Comics.
Movies.
Music.
Video games.
Technology.
Blu-ray.
Television.
This is the HHW LOD Podcast Network.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com.
Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/outnowpodcast.
Over 150,000 titles to choose from for your Android, iPhone, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Wait a minute, I forgot my introduction.
We are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and as always, this is...
Abe, hello!
Out Now is a film podcast with Abe and I discussing new movies weekly. However, every now and then, we like to have these special bonus episodes, whether it be one of our fun commentaries or something completely different. And this is one of those. This is something completely different. We have an interview.
Completely different, yeah.
Yeah. We are talking to one of the co-writers of The Signal. It's a new sci-fi film that's currently in theaters. Now, I definitely recommend you go out and see it, especially because the later half of this interview is probably going to have more spoilery stuff, and we'll be sure to mark that before we get there. But with all that said, all that preamble out of the way, we're talking to one of the co-screenwriters. It is Carlisle Eubank.
Cool. Thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Right away, I want to say we like this movie. That's
cool.
We are fans of this film, which is why we're like, hey, we should just I put up a review, and like Abe saw the movie later on, and we all kind of started tweeting it out and everything. And
right, yeah, I remember watching the trailer, and I was like, this looks like a really cool trailer. Aaron, you should watch this. Like, I've never seen that trailer, but I will go see the movie.
I saw the poster and I had a vague idea what the movie was. I'm like, yeah, I want to see it.
It's like the movie is like enigma wrapped in an enigma. Like our movie poster like says very little.
It does, yeah.
It's like a yet another mystery, but that's kind of the way we wanted it to be, you know, for better or worse. Some people really seem to like it and they dig it, and other people seem to like hate the fact that they're asking questions as they leave the theater. And I always want to say, like, why is this such a bad thing?
It's definitely not a bad thing. I think that one of the best things you can do is just have a film linger in your mind. Make you think about things. That's certainly something that Aaron and I did afterward. I was just, you and I were texting very frequently after I watched the film.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. That's great. I mean, anything that gets you thinking. Often, it's funny, oftentimes when I go to movies, sometimes I'll walk out and I'll be like really like mad at the movie. And I'll be like, oh, I hated that movie. And then I'll find myself like literally even months later still like thinking about it.
Uh-huh.
And then that's when I know I actually ultimately probably like the movie, you know, anything that makes me think for that long. I watched a movie recently, actually, while we were on pre-production for The Signal, called Upstream Color.
Ooh.
It was the guy Shane Carruth, who did Primer.
Yes.
Or Primer, I don't know how you say it.
No, Primer.
Anyways,
Primer.
It was his long-awaited second film, so we went and watched it in Santa Fe, and I just walked out of there going like, what in the hell did I just watch? Like, it's so crazy. I mean, it was supposed to be crazy, so I guess we knew what we were getting into, but at first I was just kind of annoyed with it and upset with it, but, you know, months later I was still thinking about it and how cool it was, and ultimately, I came out thinking, that's a cool movie, but it took me a while to get there, and I'm glad I didn't, you know, broadcast my feelings right away in a public way, because, you know, ultimately, I felt very differently about it, you know, months later.
I'm in a position where I write about movies on a weekly basis, so I have to kind of broadcast my feelings on a quicker kind of pace.
Yeah.
But I have
you have to have those, yeah.
But for sure, I have a very same reaction to Upstream Color last year, and it was a movie that I am a fan. I'm a much more of a fan of it now than I was when I initially saw it, just because
sometimes
you just can't really form an opinion on certain movies right away. You really have to let it kind of linger in your mind.
Yeah, total delayed reaction. I think like really big thoughts can sort of do that. You know, they have like a very delayed reaction,
mm-hmm.
which I think is good. I mean, that's like a real feeling when it takes a little bit of time to like gestate. You know.
Yeah.
But. Anyways, so I'll stop babbling.
With that said, so where did the story for this film come from?
David and William could talk more to the point of where it came from, because they actually created the idea together. I think my brother was finishing up on his previous film called Love. While that was still kind of being edited, David and William came up with just kind of a big idea. And then they pulled me aboard and we engineered a screenplay kind of around the idea. So we almost reverse engineered a story around a concept, which actually isn't as unusual as it sounds. I'm making it sound more unusual than it is, but that's sort of how it happened. They came up with an idea. I was just graduating from college. So I was still kind of like trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And they asked if I wanted to help write this thing, and I did, and we did.
Do you have a background in screenwriting in particular, or just
not
more...
a screenwriting in particular? Actually, no, I have no experience other than this movie. I have no experience in screenwriting. I studied English literature, so I guess some of that helps, but actually a lot of it, you know, was trial by fire.
Yeah. Had you ever written any short stories or anything similar to this concept in the past?
Oh, nothing similar to this concept. No, this was I had never written anything too science fiction-y, even though I really enjoyed reading science fiction. Took a couple classes in science fiction literature, but I'd never written anything. So this was my first foray into it. And it's a lot of fun to try to sort of, I don't know, think in terms of like futurist ideas and pay homage to like the writers and thinkers that you love, you know.
I should note that you mentioned David and William. William is your brother, who is also William Eubank, who also is the director and another co-writer for the film. And then there's also David, who we will be talking to on another episode, just for the listeners out there.
Cool.
So we'll have all aspects of this. But with that said, given that you say you haven't written many short stories per se, was there an aspect of why they brought you on to co-write it with them? Were you adding something in particular that they thought you could assist with? Or?
I think my brother just knew that I was like a strong writer in general, you know, even though I'd never really put it into creative writing per se. When they asked me, you know, they approached me with this idea and I gave them in response, like a few ideas of my own. I think that just sort of coupled with the fact that my brother knew I was a strong writer, strong thinker, and would just pretty quickly figure out how to write screenplay form, which it's not the most difficult thing to do at like a rudimentary level. I have a lot to learn, that's for sure. But and David's a very experienced screenwriter. He's been selling like spec scripts for a long time in Hollywood, so he's sort of an old hand at this stuff. So learning from him was definitely beneficial. But I don't know. I don't, in the end, I hope I added, you know, I hope I was value added. I think I was, but I mean, we got it done and we were pretty proud of our story. So,
would you say it was like a collaborative process? Were you all in the same area? Were you all in the same room writing or?
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah. We spent a lot of time in the room together for sure. But we ultimately kind of came up with a system where we'd sort of sit in the room together and, kind of strategize, and then we divide the work and then go write it separately. So there's actually still moments in the script where as writers we can kind of see like our direct work, because like that was our section, but then, you know, we all kind of had we all had an editorial role to play in each other's writing. So we did it, but we did it all sorts of ways. You know, we'd screen share, we'd sit in the same room, we'd talk on the, you know, we'd have phone conferences like this, and because we all live in different places, so sometimes it's just hard to be in the same room. Sometimes it's not even an advantage to be sitting in the same room. Sometimes it's just super important to be alone with your own sort of thoughts, you know.
How many iterations of the script did you guys go through?
Gosh. A lot.
Which sounds pretty standard, right?
Yeah, it is.
You're always perfecting your craft and you're always perfecting the story.
I think that the first, you know, there was like, man, there must have been like, gosh, at least six drafts. I don't know. Mm-hmm. The, you know, the first draft took maybe like, I don't know, 6 months to sort of fully put together. Don't quote me on that. I could be total, give or take.
Oh, we'll get it from David. We'll hit the real.
Yeah,
story.
David will know. Honestly, that's why I edited myself there, because David will know, and I don't want to look too stupid. But it wasn't the world's longest period of time, because we took our time in sort of plotting it out, and then, you know, the writing process from there didn't take an extremely long time. But then the editing process took like another year and a half. So. You know, just getting it to a point. I mean, we were still editing and fixing the scripts, like, while William was in pre-production, you know, when he was like, we already knew we were making the movie, but we were still fixing the script. So I don't know, that maybe that sheds a little bit of light on the kind of madness that this movie was at times.
What year was it when you came aboard the project?
It was 2011.
Right.
I want to say 2011.
A small film like that. That's a, yeah. It's a quick enough turnaround, I'd say.
Yeah, yeah, and I think when my brother pitched the idea to our producer Brian Kavanaugh Jones, who really responded to the script and loved it, said that we could do it one of two ways. We can chase the money, and we could be spending 5 or 6 years just trying to find the money to do it, you know, on a $20 million budget or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there's this sort of quicker method where we micro budget the thing and we'll get it made next year. And I think the consensus was like, let's just do this thing. Let's be creative. And my brother, obviously having done another small sort of self-produced science fiction movie, I mean, he knew how to be creative, and so he and I had to, and David had to figure out ways to write the script so that we could make things done and doable on a small budget. And he, my brother and I, devised some of the practical effects ourselves at my house up in San Ynez. And I don't know, it's just, that's the madness of you know, small budget movie making, especially when you have like an appetite and an ambition that my brother has to make small look really big.
Yeah.
And the sort of the dangers of that is it sort of shoves your movie into like a different realm of criticism, where people are really coming down hard on it and calling it, you know, trying to be too fancy. But when in reality, a lot of the fancy stuff like slow motion is just to make really like super like Walmart constructed like special effects look bigger than they are. I mean, there are some moments where, like, you know, Jonah is kind of hitting the ground,
right,
and, you know, that madness, that's like, that's trampolines and cork, you know, that I, you know, bought from Sam's Club and hauled out and dug the holes and just put under, you know, like, we just put that together ourselves, but then you use slow motion to make it look bigger than it is. And I don't know. I think it's pretty cool.
I remember watching the film, and I thought that too. I thought, this actually looks like a pretty decent budget, but it seems like you guys were on a shoestring budget. Did you have like a ballpark figure of what your budget was?
Yeah, it's like the $4 million range, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it looked bigger than that, because, again, you'd mentioned like the high speed frame shots toward the third act, and
yeah,
I mean, even when some of these mechanisms that these folks are powering up, that looked awesome. I mean, it just turns all bright red and
yeah,
they get going.
Yeah.
So, again, I think that you guys did a good job in terms of working your way to make it bigger than it seems.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of, we had to write it that way. I mean, knowing that from like a pretty early on stage, and that was, again, part of kind of rewriting during pre-production, because now we have a better idea of the sort of money we're working with, so we have to dial back on some of the more crazy things that were in earlier drafts of the script, and you know, simplifying it and making it a little more doable for my brother, you know.
without spoiling anything, or even without giving away whatever potential future plans there might be, were there versions of the script where there were much bigger things going on, given the possibility of having a larger budget? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. There were definitely some things and effects or even things that are there that were written much bigger. and you know, a lot more elaborate, you know, a lot more elaborate action sequences and mm-hmm. and fight scenes and stuff like that, you know. But you just have to scale it all back and decide sort of what's important, and then even and then a lot of things even just get changed on the day, you know, when mm-hmm. when you know the sun is going down and you have 40 minutes to get, you know, your last shot. You just have to, you know, make executive decisions and whatnot. So, yeah, just a lot of madness. I mean, I was on set for the entire shoot, just helping build and helping stage and helping find things and fix things, because we just, this has been a passion project of ours for the last 4 years of our life, and we just, I wanted to make sure that, you know, everything I could do everything that I could, you know, to make it as good as it was going to be. You know?
How long was the shoot?
We had like a, I think it was like a 25-day shoot. Right. So really short, very compressed, which made for a very wild ride. We shot in on location in New Mexico, Albuquerque, mm-hmm. and then like a few days on the end in Ohio. Yeah, just a mad schedule, long days.
I would imagine. Yeah. In terms of casting, how excited were you guys when you guys got some of the names that were billed in the film? I mean, were you guys going after those folks, or like folks like Lawrence Fishburne and Lin Shaye from Insidious.
Yeah. So Lawrence Fishburne was a huge windfall. As I understand it, he read the script and he's a pretty big fanboy of science fiction, isn't too much of a surprise, but he read the script and thought it was really interesting. He said he couldn't put it down, so he was all in, which is, was a huge vote of confidence for us. We were all pretty excited about that. And then Lin Shaye was awesome. Oh man, she is the sweetest lady. I had a lot of good talks with her on set about her character, who she just brought it. She brought a level of like intensity to her character, level of intensity and depth to her character that, you know, even as a writer, I couldn't have imagined. So kudos to her for that. But she's worked with our producer. The producer of this film is Brian, who also produced the Insidious movies. So he has a good relationship with her. And I guess, you know, he read the part and thought, you know, Lin would be perfect for it, and he was right. She was absolutely perfect.
Yeah, that's a perfect kind of Lin Shaye role. Like, she's a great character actress. And yeah, that's a great kind of role.
When she's got the interrogation scene going on, I was like, this is spooky. She does. She plays that off very well.
With Lawrence Fishburne, for that kind of character, that seems like a very type of, it seems like the kind of character Lawrence Fishburne would play. Was that like a was that a person that you had in mind, or like when you were like kind of visualizing who this person could be played by, was that one of them?
You know, when we wrote the character, it's funny, the person we actually envisioned was which is completely not science fiction, but we were thinking actually more of a Javier from No Country for Old Men.
Javier Bardem,
Anton Chigurh.
Yeah.
kind of almost an emotionless, sort of nihilistic type individual, with kind of almost like a strange voice. Like those were like kind of the big things, and the person we thought was the most sort of unnerving would have been like an Anton Chigurh, you know. Mm-hmm. But that said, you know, when Lawrence Fishburne indicated he was interested, it was like, that's, yeah, I mean, we could totally see it. Like we knew that character was in good hands with him. So
was there any restructuring of the script in any way once you had Lawrence Fishburne in mind, or
no, actually, believe it or not, no, he was down with the script as it was. And it's pretty incredible because he spent the entire movie in the most uncomfortable like hazmat suit. It was like made of canvas, and like I think the thing weighed like 100 pounds.
Oh wow!
It's
like a Batman suit.
He was like outside in like 100-degree weather, like inside the suit. I think it got up to like 150 degrees in those things.
Boy.
I mean, it was gnarly, and he was such a good sport. But I will say those things, like we got hit by a ton of sandstorms, and it was so hilarious because when those things would come up, the people like in their hazmat suits were like fine. They would just like close their masks and be standing there like juggernauts. Like they didn't even phase them when the rest of us were running to our cars, and it's pretty hilarious.
Not only that, but you guys actually got Brenton Thwaites, who he's going to be in The Giver. He's like up and
yeah,
coming.
He's and having
he's
also huge,
he's had a huge in Maleficent. He was
yeah,
in
Prince
Charming. Oculus.
Yeah.
Oculus.
And it was an Oculus.
Oculus,
right.
Yeah. I liked Oculus quite a bit.
I haven't seen it. I really want to see that movie. I've heard good things about it. But yeah, Brenton's had a super year. I mean, he's on the upswing for sure. You know, when we cast him, I guess my brother's experience with casting him, because we had a lot of people read for the part. My brother just knew he wanted him because my brother was crazy with pre-production and he was a little bit late to their call. And when he got on the phone with Brenton, Brenton was just like the most like easygoing, like easy along with sweet guy. And my brother just knew like, okay, this is the guy I want. Like, he's like, I don't know. He just knew like the energy was perfect. Cause he knew probably on a subconscious level, this movie was going to be nuts and he needed someone who was just going to be like cool with like rolling with the punches. Yeah. And then come day one of shooting, you know, Brenton sitting opposite Lawrence Fishburne just brought it. I mean, he was amazing. Like the whole, like everyone behind the camera was just like, oh my gosh, like this kid has chops. Like, he's good.
Where am I? I can't move.
Can you tell me your name?
Nicholas Eastman.
I'm Damon. Dr. Wallace Damon. I'm heading up the transition team that's going to help you, help all of us understand exactly what you've been through.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, I mean, his character Nick, I really empathize with his character a lot, and I like the way that you guys had structured it in such a way that there are some flashback sequences to show you that he was like a cross-country athlete. And you don't really know what happened to him now. I'm kind of guessing it's almost like what Stephen Hawking has.
Yeah, it's like a MS, like a muscular.
Like early phases, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that made it all the more, you know, devastating as a character. So
yeah, for sure.
Just enjoyed it. Like, his strength of acting was very well done too. I think that Aaron and I both liked him as the lead.
Yeah, he was awesome. I mean, we couldn't have picked anyone like better. I mean, he brought it. We were not disappointed by any means. And everything else is, you know, that's happening to him. Super excited for him. Be exciting to see where he goes and what he does.
To make things a bit less vague for the listeners that might not have seen The Signal yet, but are for some reason listening to this interview, I want to somewhat describe the plot. Not quite going to spoiler territory yet, but
sure, yeah.
So the movie it revolves around these three college age kids. We have Nick, played by Brenton Thwaites, Jonah, and. Bo Knapp. And Haley, played by Olivia Cooke, and they're on this kind of road trip, and they're at least Nick and Jonah, they're from MIT, right? They have
computer science engineers.
They're having like a hacking.
They kind of have a hacking
sort of
bent,
competition,
yeah.
Sort of a hacking feud. Yeah.
With another.
Yeah, they just have like a hacking sort of like feud going with this guy who broke into their school's servers and then put the hack on them and almost got them expelled, mm-hmm. like just sort of goading them, you know.
Yeah.
So they have like this beef with this guy.
Yes, and the story, they try to track him down and the story goes from there, which I won't get into too much, but I do want I'm going to use some vague terms here, but the way I saw the film, it kind of was divided into three distinct parts. You had kind of this road trip beginning aspect. Then you have this middle portion that's involved in kind of quarantine zone with Lawrence Fishburne's character.
Captivity,
yeah. And then the final third is more of a kind of a you're set on kind of a highway.
Yeah, like a chase film, but with like David Lynch elements.
Yes, for sure. Was there a conscious effort to write the film in these kind of three distinct parts?
You broke it down. Yeah, you nailed it. I mean, for better or worse, some people seem to really, like I said before, you know, people either seem to really respond to that, or they find it disjointed and hard to hang together. But that's sort of kind of why it's billed as a genre-bending film, because we start with this kind of young love indie road film, and then it becomes something totally different, and then it becomes something totally different again. Which all is extremely intentional, you know. I mean, the movie feels like it sort of runs away with itself, but it's totally deliberate. You know, we deliberately sort of ramp up the action as it proceeds.
That's certainly kind of how it feels. You have these characters that get in over their head to an extent, and there's just some really big changes that occur. And yeah, then it just kind of has this kind of gradual build. And I really like that. I like that, and I like that it kind of messes with you. I like that the
I like that aspect of it too. Actually,
there's kind of a way the film reveals different layers as to what exactly is going on, because there's a lot of mystery.
Yeah.
There's a ton of, I mean, even like just saying the signal, that's the mystery right there. It's like, I don't know what that is.
I know.
When you guys were kind of developing the story, did you already have kind of an end in sight on it?
Yeah. The end was like the first thing we knew. You know, we started with our ending in many ways, as writers. And then it was a matter of deciding where we wanted to start it. And then we had a vague kind of idea. I mean, this is really early on. We had a vague idea of where we wanted a good meat of the film to be. And then it's just connecting the dots, you know, it's oversimplifying the process, but that's basically kind of how it evolved.
I have a couple more questions I want to say before we get into kind of a more spoilery aspect of it. You kind of described this already, but were you, in writing the film, were you guys writing to the more visual effect heavy sequences? Was there like how that would kind of end up playing out? Was that a part of the writing process?
Definitely part of the process. My brother, who co-wrote the film and directed it, especially because he already had a lot of ideas about what he wanted things to look like and how he wanted them to work.
And he has a background in the sort of thing as well.
And he's a very visual director, because he's done a lot of cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
So we were definitely at times writing to that, you know, trying to get the story to that visual moment, you know. But always, obviously always, the visual moments are not sort of like empty stylish moments, as some people have wanted to think they are. They're all very, to us, very emblematic of the larger sort of dichotomy of the movie, which is this sort of struggle this kid's having between, you know, his sort of failing physical systems and his like mind, and which is he going to rely on, you know, his like his brute strength or his emotional or his like logical, rational self. And so a lot of the very ballistic visual moments are those like emotional sort of releases that these characters have like had pent up for a long time, if that makes any sense, if that sheds any light on anything.
No, it does. Yeah. I mean, that's actually one of the things I enjoyed a lot too, which is, you know, it does take you through that stewing process of you're getting to know these characters, you're really starting to understand that they're very frustrated, so you start feeling their frustrations out on the screen. And then you have the action pieces, and it's not just like a quick and dirty, it's kind of like they're actually prolonged and they all have their own set pieces, and
yeah,
I found that immensely enjoyable and satisfying, because it was exactly like the amount of action that I would have wanted to see.
There was some emotional weight put to it, just based on what these characters have gone through that seemed to come through.
Yeah, for sure.
How about the music? Were you guys involved in that process at all? Or
my brother was very involved with that, but that was Nima.
Fakara.
Yeah, Fakara. Yeah, Nima Fakara. So my brother spent a lot of time in his studio with him, and they would just hash out ideas, and you know, they would put temp music in, and then, you know, Nima would get sort of the emotional, he would sort of decide what the emotional quality of the temp music is, and then try to sort of recreate it in sort of an original way. The soundtrack and the music was very, there was a very hands-on process on my brother's part,
which I have since bought there. Because I really like the soundtrack for this film.
Yeah, it's a cool soundtrack. Yeah. Nima's a super cool guy. Was so excited about the movie, and he put his heart and soul into it. And the soundtrack is really good. I mean, it's really cool.
It's good to write to. I like writing to a lot of kind of atmospheric scores, and that's a good one.
He was brought up in, I think he was in Hans Zimmer's camp. So he's definitely, he's a top-notch guy, but he does his own thing now. I hope to see him doing bigger and better things from here on, you know?
And just in terms, before we get to the spoiler parts.
Sure.
When you guys were sending these out to film festivals and whatever else, how excited were you when you guys were getting responses like, hey, look, it's been accepted, and we really want you guys to come to check it out with everybody.
Well, the big one, you know, obviously was Sundance. I mean, it's been like a major goal of my brother as a filmmaker to get a project into Sundance. So that in and of itself was like, you know, we could have been satisfied right there, and we were. I mean, it just was an awesome process, and. We knew some of these things were a long shot. So when you get Sundance, it's almost hard to sort of, I don't know, understand that, because it's a big deal. I mean, it feels like such a big deal, and it is a big deal, but ultimately you just want people to see it and enjoy it. You know, the festivals are awesome for exposure and and bragging rights and all that. But ultimately, your goal as a writer and filmmaker is just to create something that will, you know, speak to people and touch people, inspire people, and hopefully not anger people, but yeah.
All right. So let's move into more kind of a spoilery area for anyone that, you know, hasn't seen The Signal yet, or, you know, that wants to kind of preserve certain surprises. I'd say I'd advise you to kind of stop this podcast at this point.
Go see the movie.
That's what you should be doing, because it's a really interesting film that I think deserves to be seen. So we can pause for a second. Abe can insert some kind of crazy sound or something. It'd be amazing. Okay, some more spoilery centric questions now. First off, when kind of developing this story, was there any other kind of media or films or books that you were kind of thinking of and like keeping in mind when kind of developing the story?
I think my brother, especially since it was my brother and David's concepts, but we definitely expounded and built on them. But major sort of concepts we were playing with were the idea of like singularity. And a lot of that actually is built into the backstory of the film, which really doesn't actually come through in the story. It was more of like if we, God willing, had an opportunity to do a second film, we would have gone into like, who are these people that have abducted Nick and Jonah and Haley, and why are they so interested in them? But sort of reading a lot of like, Michio Kaku and these other sort of futurist thinkers just thinking about like the intersection between our emotions as humans and our increased dependency on technology, you know, which in and of itself is this dichotomy of logic versus emotion. Mm-hmm. And the idea that if we evolved enough in a direction where we depend more and more on technology, would we eventually phase out the need for emotion, because we'd be purely rational creatures. And then based on that, if something were to evolve so far that it completely was removed from its emotional ancestry, would it ever decide it was in its best interest to go explore what it lost, you know, to go back to planet Earth and look at the creatures that they put there, you know, and see, you know, what this emotional thing is all about. Is it worth looking into anymore? Is it worth sort of reprogramming back into themselves?
Right.
And you touched upon this too, Carla, just very briefly. The three main leads are abducted by alien life forms. And what's cool is the reveal is, when you think about it afterward, the line question that Lawrence Fishburne asked Nick, that's actually a really cool thing to think about after the fact, knowing that they are the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, we're not sure what we're dealing with here. It's like, oh, I see. Interesting. You guys are studying the humans and getting a better sense of what's out there. Once you have that reveal, the writing becomes very, very clever.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's funny because the story is riddled with double talk. Like when Fishburne asks, like, and you have to ask yourself, did I find what I was looking for? Like, it's a double-edged question. I mean, that's Damon as a scientist on behalf of the aliens asking, did he find what he was looking for? Because he's been long since searching for someone who could successfully integrate their technology with, you know, an emotional sort of undercarriage, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Because it's sort of, it was his task as, like, the head of this outdated bureaucratic, you know, like underling bureaucratic.
Yeah, everything that Nick describes.
You know, it was his task to find someone who could handle their technology, you know, in their bodies. And so, it's the whole thing is riddled with double talk. Like Damon as human scientist and Damon as alien who's genuinely interested in learning more about these characters as a species, not just as an abducted, possibly infected person. So it was very difficult to engineer that. And sometimes, you know, even watching it myself, sometimes I'm like, oh, I'd tweak that a little bit or, you know, I'd change that a little bit. But for the most part, we dialed that in and most things are double-edged, which is tough, a very tough task. To accomplish.
In many ways, this film kind of feels like an origin story for some kind of, you know, like a superhero, for instance, because we have, we have Nick, who is, you know, mechanically enhanced, and suddenly he can do things that he was far not be able to do before. Was it thought about in that way?
Oh, sure. I mean, we have like this, we have a lot, and still have a lot of big ideas about kind of where they go and what they do and what their sort of purpose is. But, you know, those we'll save for a rainy day if there's
enough.
Ever an avenue for them.
Would it be fair to say there's some ambiguity over whether or not Jonah is dead? We saw just kind of a big
dust
cloud.
There's definitely ambiguity. Ambiguity.
Okay.
You know, on an alien planet, a lot of things are sort of ambiguous.
Right.
What happens to people and what they're made of anymore, and definitely ambiguous.
And I guess along the same lines, which I'm sure is probably more of an ambiguous statement, we have, you know, Jonah has ground pounding abilities. Nick
exactly.
has super legs. We kind of saw that Haley has been involved with something, but we didn't see any kind of enhancement. Was there?
Hers is like more of like a spinal nervous enhancement. Which would have been a lot of fun to get into, but again, it's like, you know, you have to write to your budget, you know.
Yeah, we're talking like Jean Grey territory.
It was going to be pretty wild stuff. Pretty wild stuff. That's all I'll say. But
that's fair. Yeah.
You know, we definitely had them all sort of, kind of, equipped. I'll say, and had we had the opportunity in this one to explore hers, we would have. But we really had to sort of confine it. And leave hers more of a mystery, which is still, it has merit, I think, to leave it kind of a mystery because you're wondering, like, well, what's her power, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
But we just, you know, the story we were dealing with couldn't have necessarily handled like another explosive power.
Yeah, it would have felt the same.
Especially on the magnitude that hers is.
One of my favorite scenes is actually. when Nick is just powering up and he starts running, and then he goes supersonic, and it's like, this is amazing. This is like one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
Oh yeah, it was fun, right? It's fun writing that stuff because you can just sort of say whatever you want, because ultimately, you know,
what was that line? What did that line look like? He runs really fast.
Yeah, it was basically that. It was like, choo! It was just noises. Choo, 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 choo. I don't know. Yeah, who knows? But it is funny because you kind of, especially the first time you write it, you're like trying to amp it up and make it sound intense. And, you know, it's sort of like he looks to his left and he sees he's running faster than a fucking bullet or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which... I think originally we had planned for him to look and see like a bullet literally kind of like at zero velocity next to him because they're moving at the same speed. But you know, that's another constraint. So we just, you know, opted for a zoom and a, you know, blast off.
I kind of saw a hint of it because, you know, you have the kind of the guy shooting at him, and I was kind of thinking, huh, yeah, I wonder if those, yeah. I was kind of waiting to see if there's a chance to get bullets, yeah, like, in the
frame.
That's
as close as we could get to the this script.
Which I think made it very interesting for you to imagine, like, this guy's running so fast that the bullet can't even, it's not even going to touch him. Like, he's just super, super sonic. One of the things that I liked about it, the viewing, actually, is my theater, there was probably, like, six people in my theater.
Yeah.
And again, Aaron and I were surprised that it was playing because it not as much marketing efforts per se, but
I know
it's just it's a small kind of film, and I saw it in my giant multiplex.
Yeah, same here. Yeah. I saw it was playing in like four theaters around me, which was very happy.
It's tough. Originally, they were only going to put it in five theaters the first weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be one of those things like L.A. and New York only, and then the trailer kind of went. I don't know if I can say it went viral, but it definitely
caught
was
on.
Getting a lot of hits and a lot of talk. And so the distributor was like, oh, maybe we should try to push it to 120. But I don't know that their sort of marketing strategy changed, even though they were pushing it to more theaters.
Hmm.
I mean, I can't really speak for them, but it's, from my perspective, that's sort of what happened was it was going to go to bigger markets, more theaters, but without sort of all of the press you need behind it to let people know. I think that one of the biggest issues is no one really knew it was out. But you know, whatever. I mean, as long as people are going to see it and enjoying it, that's all that matters.
They enjoyed. They did, because what I was gonna say is there was the moment where Haley gets picked up into the sky. The guy in front of me is just like, "What the?" That's when you know people are invested. And then later, when Jonah's doing the ground pound, like Aaron calls it, there's this woman that just gasps. She's just like, and I was like, this is awesome. This is exactly probably what filmmakers
are
going
for.
Like,
man,
this is exactly the emotions.
Lo-fi effects, man. Super lo-fi effects. Like the abduction pole was like this decision. We were sitting there talking. My brother and I and the stunt guy and a few other people. And it was like, you know, in the script, there was like kind of an elaborate abduction scene, kind of what you might picture in an abduction scene. And then again, budget struck and it just became clear that the scarier, more intense option was like the more like low budget option, you know, just like someone getting yanked up into darkness is way scarier, you know?
Yeah.
And I still think that it looks pretty cool.
Agree. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty fun. I always enjoy that moment because that's sort of where this, like, I don't know, this emotionally charged indie road trip just kind of like blasts off, so to speak.
Right.
And it's always exciting to me to watch it sort of get bent there because you're starting to venture into territory where you're like, oh God, these two kids are just like, yeah, I don't know. You care about them, but it's also like, they're just kids doing like kid emotional stuff. And it's just so satisfying to get it like pushed into new territory all of a sudden. I don't know. I think it's fun.
It is. I mean, because it is a, you know, it is a mixing of different genres, and it takes a decidedly different turn, and the, you know, the goat basically just jumps right into the second act there as you get into the kind of closed off section.
Yeah, very distinct cut.
Just a couple more questions here.
Sure.
What do you think would happen if Nick and Jonah never went out to seek Nomad? You ever think about that? Where these characters could have gone?
Because there's that point where Haley says, like, hey, like, let's not do this.
To me, it's like, it was sort of an inevitability. And I think that it's like, from, like, say, Nomad's perspective, like, he's been he's been looking for someone for a long time to sort of heed the call, you know, and you know, once you get to their world, you realize they've been abducting like crazy people for a long time, which, if you've ever met someone who's been abducted, you're always kind of like, why did aliens abduct this guy? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, wouldn't they want someone who could like use a computer, or like, you know, speak intelligently about human technology, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's sort of like Nomad is like, okay, we've got to up our game. We've got to like pick people who are going to like respond to our beckoning. And in this case, it took the form of like, kind of like a hacking pissing contest, if you will, to be kind of crude. And so it was sort of inevitable that like Nick would heed the call, because, you know, he's got so much riding on it beyond just like kind of like proving himself as a hacker. It's also like him sort of proving himself to himself, because his body is failing. And so he can't rely on all the things he used to identify with, like running and just being a normal person. So he's slowly receding into the world of the mind, you know? And so now, when his intelligence is insulted, like, he's going to go all in. So to me, it's like inevitable. Like, and those are the kinds of characters you want to write, the ones who are inevitably going to end up in this situation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like a destiny, almost a legacy kind of situation. Like, this is Nick's legacy. This is his destiny.
And with that, what do you guys have anything planned next in terms of future film, or do you want to continue writing for?
Oh yeah, sure. I've got like three or four different projects in various stages of development, I'll say. I mean, it's pretty vague.
With your brother still, or?
Yeah, definitely. I have a bigger project with my brother and David, actually, about super deep mining in South Africa, gold mining. But it's also a fantasy film, so it's kind of another genre bending type movie, where it starts as a mine rescue film and then ventures into much darker territory. And and then I actually have another project in development with my wife, who's also a writer. And it's more of a like dramatic horror film set in Central Valley of California.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Where I'm born.
Oh, so it's based on a true story.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we should talk.
Yeah. I'll tell you everything you need to know about Fresno.
Yeah, it's set up in Merced.
The scariest of Central California cities.
Yeah, like 20 minutes away.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, just things here and there, and just keep poking along, trying to get them better and make them as good as you can. But yeah, definitely going to keep writing and try to make better and better films, you know? Cool.
Well, I hope everything, you know, works out well enough, and I hope that more people go out and see The Signal, because it is
many
theaters now, and it deserves to be seen, and, you know, who knows, if enough people see it could go on to have more Signals, the obvious sequel title.
Exactly.
And Carl,
spread the word, man. I mean, you guys are awesome, and I can't thank you enough for spreading good vibes about it. It's just super cool.
For sure.
And Carl, so cool. People get to know you a little bit better, what are some movies that you like, and what are some movies that you would recommend people go see, like, right now?
Oh, right now. Gosh, I'm, like, kind of, like, right now movie illiterate. let's see, like, what was the last movie I saw? Oh, it's embarrassing. It's, like, one of those questions where you always forget when people ask. But my favorite movies are actually like not very science fictiony. I'll just admit it. I love Hitchcock. I love his sensibilities. Because one thing I love about Hitchcock is he's like, he's very mysterious, but he also just like gives you answers at unexpected times. And you're just sort of like, oh, I thought that was sort of the ultimate mystery. And then you realize like there's a bigger mystery yet, you know? And I love that. And always trying to figure out how he does that, you know? So anything by Hitchcock, you know, North by Northwest or Strangers on a Train. But more contemporary movies, relatively, I love There Will Be Blood.
Yes.
Any movie that like pays homage to like silent filmmaking in like an era when like oversaturation of like CG and all that is just like, but does it and still captivates people, just like that to me is a great movie. And the first like 25 minutes of There Will Be Blood, there's like hardly any talking. Yeah. And I think that's amazing. To tell story without words is just, I mean, that's like the number one principle of storytelling, is show, don't tell, you know? So, I don't know, crazy films like that. I love the movie Amadeus. It's one of my favorite movies. But I don't know. I'm trying to think like really hard right now.
Yeah, no worries.
So I don't sound like out of fashion or something.
You have some pretty recent and very good movies that you've just called out.
Yeah. But
anyhow,
if I had a week where I was watching movies and I was like, what am I gonna watch this week? Well, I got Amadeus and There Will Be Blood there, I'd be pretty happy with that week.
Yeah. I actually watch a lot of like net, you know, television shows right now. So like I love like Game of Thrones, obviously, and I'll admit like one of my guilty pleasures is Downton Abbey. So elegant. But I don't know.
Very cool.
Well, Carlo, where can people find more of your work? Do you have a website or anything? Or
I do not have a website. I have like almost no web presence.
How about Twitter?
I do have a Twitter. I am, what am I? I think I'm like Carlyle Eubank, but Carlyle and then
underscore
Eubank.
Oh,
no,
Eubank.
I just add the E, the last E in my first name and the first E in my last name. Okay. Just put them together.
We'll be sure to put it on the show notes for this episode.
Yeah, sure.
But Carlyle, you've been very generous with your time. We thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure, honestly. I mean, thank you so much for supporting our film and telling people about it. And I'm glad that you got something out of it in a positive way.
For sure. I hope to see more work from you guys in the future, because I like seeing new and interesting voices in the world of film. So.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, guys.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Talk to you later.